Who let the dogs out?
Who let the dogs out?
It is time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. With us today, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, owner, chief vet, and czarina at the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Hello, Dr. Cannon.
Good morning. See, how are you today?
We are well, and I've just been able to invoke the famous czarina. So
I heard that. I heard that plug for czarina.
Yeah, well, every so often, you know, you just have to mention them. Matt in Dover Plains, what are some safe things for my teething puppy to gnaw? I feel like every time I buy him a product that's supposedly made specifically for chewing, I read an article warning me against buying that exact product. He's a pit bull, in case that matters.
Well, I think the warnings are about, you know, what is in the product. It's not they're not necessarily about the teeth, which is what I will address. But the safest thing to do is not to buy any products that are made in China. Probably the best thing to do is to buy products that are made in the United States, because of the restrictions on what can be given for food. But as far as teeth goes, if you ask a veterinary dentist, they pretty much will tell you not to let a dog chew on anything harder or hard enough that they wouldn't want to be whacked in the kneecap with it, believe it or not.
That's a good rule of thumb. I like that one.
I guess. It used to say that you wouldn't want to be knocked in the kneecap with, but that doesn't really work for a 2-pound chihuahua.
I was
going
to say, for a chihuahua, that's exactly what I was picturing.
Right. The idea is that anything really hard makes microfractures in the teeth, and over the years, you can get this coalescing of the microfractures, just like we do, and then you bite into something soft, and then your tooth breaks. So, you know, that being said, they are dentists, and so that's what they see. There's risk in living and eating and chewing, and so you have to weigh that with a puppy pit bull who needs to chew like mad. And so you can use rawhide chews that are safe to consume. Things like pig's ears, which smell terrible when dogs chewed on them and they're in the house, but those are soft enough. The bully sticks are digestible. That's a bull's penis dried out. They're completely digestible, and they're fun to chew on for most dogs. You can use those rawhide strips appropriate for the size of your dog, but of course when you do that, if you have a very vigorous chewer, which pit bulls tend to be, you want to be supervising them with those, because we don't want any choking to happen. So you have to be careful of the type of thing that you're putting in their mouth as far as ingredients from China that might not be regulated. You have to be careful about them chewing it too fast, because it might not digest a huge piece in the stomach, or they might choke on it. And then you have to be careful of the teeth. So I can understand why this is a common question that's asked. And it's difficult to maneuver.
Yeah. Has anybody invented like popsicles?
Popsicles?
Well, yeah.
There are frozen yogurts that come in the little cups. Dogs like those. I made them at home with those biodegradable cups.
Yeah.
And so they're really fun, but I've been giving them in the cups for years, and I've never had my dog eat one until this last time when I tried the biodegradable cups, and Django ate the whole cup. Actually, I think he ate both dogs' cups because I wasn't supervising. So nothing bad happened there. They're biodegradable, but you have to be careful of that with dogs, that they don't eat the yummy yogurt-flavored cup. But there are molds that you can use to make popsicles.
I'm just thinking, I'm now on this whole other doggy kneecap thing, and microfracture, which of course never occurred to you know, back in the day, you used to throw something as, here, have some concrete.
Right. And dogs evolved eating bones, chewing on bones. So I do let my dogs With the known risks, I let my dogs chew on fresh bones.
And
not frozen.
Those are,
thaw them out.
And those are marrow bones typically, or knuckles?
Yes.
Yeah.
Knuckles or marrow bones. I let them chew the marrow bones. Mostly they're licking out the fat, you know,
right.
The marrow. So you have to be careful about that too, because dogs can't tolerate
too much.
Some dogs can't tolerate too much fat, right? So you have to dole that out in small amounts. Or
the
take
knuckles.
Some of the marrow out.
Yep, yeah, which I've done that. When I say I've done that, these are just like civilian things that you just do without knowing what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
Kind of thing. And knuckles are good in as much as they don't have the that degree of fat in it.
Exactly. Yeah, and of course the rubber Kongs are wonderful, but dogs don't really dig in and chew on them. They lick.
Right.
I'm
waiting, because one of these years, I'm probably going to be on my very last canine when I get one that likes a Kong and thinks it's worth its time and energy. But it's just one of those things that I hear all these stories about, how happy people are. I'm like, guys, what's the matter with you?
Puppies. You know, puppies tend to really like the Kong.
Yeah.
It depends on what you put in it.
True.
You have to find something that's really wonderful. I have always used yogurt with blueberries, or yogurt with a spoonful of peanut butter, like a teaspoon of peanut butter, and then put them in the freezer.
So
we've
got
this frozen yogurt in the middle of the Kong.
So possibly would that work for a teething? If it were the right size, could it work for teething?
It could. Yeah, it could very much. I mean, they can gnaw on that, and then, you know, you can use that. I usually buy the wholesome hide, W-H-O-L-E, wholesome hides, for chewing as well. They're only treated with hydrogen peroxide, and they are strips of, they're supposed to be one sheet of rawhide rolled up, which means it's more difficult to get a piece off, but I have always supervised that chewing. You know, because if you've got a vigorous chewer, they're going to get a piece off eventually, and then you need to be able to take it away from them.
Yeah, but
so you practice first taking things away.
But once you learn, I mean, that's good practice anyway. And once you learn,
mm-hmm.
The main thing that I wish someone had told me a million years ago is you got to supervise this. You just have to supervise this.
Yeah.
As because I used to just pitch the rawhide as I was leaving. That was the treat. Like, where you go? And
mm-hmm.
Good news, nothing bad came. Nothing happened, but still, it was
right.
It was a learned behavior.
You definitely want to avoid deer antlers. They're super, super hard. And avoid the dry cow hooves. They're also very, very hard. And think twice about the nylabone.
Oh, the only thing that were ever fun were those nylabone dinosaurs that had the little chewy thingies on them, but they're too soft in the end.
I don't remember.
Oh, I keep them just for decor. They're so funny, because like, you get a brontosaurus or a tyrannosaurus, or, you know, depends on the, but they had little nublets on them. Not literal nylabone turkey, but they had little nublets on them, which...
That are edible.
Well, I don't know if they were edible, but they massaged the gum, basically.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Uh-huh.
And again, supervised, so you didn't come home missing a head or
right.
one of those pointy things on the spine called, but anyway.
Spinous process.
That's it. Oh, what happened to the brontosaurus? All right. Jessie in Millerton, I got a sweet little guinea pig last month. This week she's been sneezing on and off. Everything is starting to go into blossom out in the yard. Could she have allergies?
The key is, if she's sneezing once or twice a day, she's probably just clearing irritants out of the nose, like pollens. And if she's acting fine, that's probably all that's going on. So is it a true allergy? Probably not. She's just clearing out all those irritating, spiky pollens out of her nose. If there's a lot more sneezing, if there's nasal discharge, if she's not eating well, if she's a little punky and doesn't look great and not cleaning herself well, then you need to think about respiratory disease like Bordetella. They can get pneumonia from Bordetella. They can get just rhinitis, meaning irritation in the nose with lots of runny nose. They can actually get ear infections too from that. So That means a trip to the vet if there are other symptoms or if it becomes progressive. But a little bit of sneezing on and off, which is, seems to me that that's what's going on here, not to worry.
All right. Carissa also, Carissa in Millbrook, I adopted a kitten from an out-of-state shelter this week. Maxwell's 4 months old and the sweetest little guy ever, but the shelter isn't the greatest at communicating, and they told me after the fact that his mother has FIV and that Maxwell's tested positive for FIV antibodies. I can't get an appointment for him for another few weeks. Is there a difference between having FIV antibodies and having FIV? What am I supposed to do going forward?
There is a big difference. Excuse me. The antibodies are probably from the mother's milk, and so you don't know whether this kitten has FIV or not. I would take a guess that he probably doesn't, but you need to know for sure. So those antibodies only last a certain period of time, and there are other tests to do. So you can repeat the test for antibodies every month until he's 6 months old. If he's still got antibodies at 6 months, it's more suspicious that he actually has FIV, or you can do the PCR test, the polymerase chain reaction test, which tests for the organism itself, for the viral DNA. Yes, FIV is caused by a virus. So you can do that PCR test, and if that comes up negative, even with the PCR test, there are a few false negatives, a few false positives. So you definitely want to verify if your kitten comes up positive, even on the PCR test. I would test again a month later with the same test.
All right,
it's a bit complicated, but
it doesn't seem like it's so horrible that he's
got
to wait for another few weeks.
It's definitely a good chance that the kitten doesn't have FIV from the mom.
And so, because it seems, I'm possibly reading this wrong, but the gist seems to be that she can't get an appointment for another few weeks, and is that going to be a problem for his health?
It shouldn't be a problem. You should keep him away from other cats, just in case. But he, I think you said he was 4 months old,
yeah.
So, waiting, if he was tested, I would find out from the shelter how young was he when he was tested so that you can tell your veterinarian. And, waiting a few weeks is fine, actually, because you want that time to go by to see if those antibodies come back negative, or your vet might decide just to do the PCR test, which is more expensive. Just keep him away from other cats.
Keep him away from other cats and call the non-communicative shelter again and find out when that test was.
Exactly.
And then for the rest, you're fine until your appointment.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
It's not transmitted to people.
Okay. Jamie in Camden, New Jersey. I have a 2-year-old healthy house rabbit, Captain Glee. When my new roommates got a puppy, we were all focused on whether Captain Glee could handle it, and so far all is cool. But yesterday I found out that a puppy's bite is somehow toxic to rabbits, and now I am kind of terrified. Their pup's been gentle so far, but he's just a baby and definitely makes mistakes. Do we have to keep them separate? That seems unfair to both of them, but what do we do if he bites the captain?
There's nothing that I can think of that would cause a toxicity from a dog bite to a rabbit, unless the dog had tularemia, which rabbits can get. And that would be not something that's even talked about in veterinary school with dogs. I know dogs can get tularemia from eating rabbits, if you have a dog who's eating wild rabbits all the time, potentially. But if your dog's healthy, if the puppy's healthy, puppy hasn't been out and about killing wild rabbits, so... the danger is that the bunny will get very, very stressed by a bite and also infected by a bite. Their skin is quite loose and doesn't it doesn't tear easily, but you can get a puncture. I think that it's a great idea to get them accustomed to each other, but you need to supervise and be right there so that things don't get out of hand. If your rabbit gets a dog puncture, a bite wound, then he will definitely need to be taken to the veterinarian. So you know, holding him in your lap, sitting on the floor holding him in your lap while the puppy is sniffing and licking would not be a bad idea if you want them to be out together, you know, in the house later on. When no one is directly supervising, then they should be separated for sure.
All right. And I'm just reading over the way the question is constructed, and basically I'm going to just...
Maybe there's something on the internet that says puppy bites are toxic.
Yeah, and I think that don't need to worry. If that's the real concern, I would, you know, unwind that one and then be as careful as you guys are being, and obviously keep them supervised is all I would say. I think the puppy's bite is toxic to rabbits is where the... Like a snake bite or something. I'm thinking venom.
Yeah, no, nothing that I'm aware of.
All right. Well.
I always have to say that instead of my definitive no, nothing that I'm aware of. But I've never heard such a thing.
And you've at least been practicing for more than a week and a half. So,
right.
All right. And speaking of urban legend or not, have you ever heard of such a thing, Hannah in Torrington? Are white cats really more prone to being deaf or losing their hearing, or is that an urban legend?
It's not an urban legend. White cats and white dogs are, especially with light-colored irises, like pale blue eyes, are much more likely to have a genetic defect that can cause deafness. And cats, I think that we just probably see more white cats. But I have seen a white dog with lacking pigment around the eyes, not necessarily an albino who was born deaf as well. And I believe what the deal is that the genes that are expressed for all this white coat and white skin, they prevent the expression of the pigment. So there has to be pigment and these little hairs on the cochlea, which is the apparatus in the middle part of the ear, the inner part of the ear that's responsible for hearing. And so those little hairs don't develop and the pigment doesn't develop, and so you end up with a deaf cat. So absolutely, although not all of them are deaf.
Right. But some of them are.
Most of them are.
Okay.
But the majority is what my understanding is.
All right. And same with dogs or...
Well, you know, you don't see that many dogs that are white like that. So that's, I couldn't speak to dogs,
okay.
Whether they're, I do see, we usually see dogs who, when they're white, those little Maltese, et cetera, like that, they're white coated. No, absolutely not. But sometimes I'll see a larger breed dog that clearly is lacking pigment other places. When you look at a Westie or a Maltese, they have the pigment around the eyes and around the mouth, etc. And so they are usually normal. In fact, I don't think I've ever met a Maltese that's deaf, except for very, very old ones.
Yes.
But if you look at a dog who's got that piebald look with like a horse with a... I don't know about horses as far as deafness goes, but it's that very strong expression of white coat and no pigment, except it's not completely albino. Those are look a little bit different. Their eyes are more pink, but they can be more prone to this deafness, and we know why now. So I would say not as common in dogs as it is in cats.
Okay. Neil in Canaan, my dog Sally turned 6 this year. She's an American Bulldog and in good health, other than being a little pudgy. I've noticed a bluish cast to her eyes lately and assumed it meant she was developing cataracts, but my trainer says the bluish color is normal in dogs as they age. Is he right?
It depends on whether the haze is from the cornea, which is that clear covering over the eye that you can see through. If there's a haze there, then that means there's edema or water retained in the cornea, and that is definitely abnormal. Or if the haze is behind the cornea, which is in the lens, then it can be a normal aging change called nuclear sclerosis. And it means that the lens is becoming cloudy. 6 years old is young for that. So it doesn't sound right to me. I would definitely have them checked.
Okay. And it's not just an automatic, oh, hey, it's bluish is goodish.
Yeah. I mean, I would I would think 6 years old in any breed, really, even in a, you know, in a Great Dane, you wouldn't necessarily see that aging change in the eye. So have your veterinarian have a look and look into the, through the lens, see how much of the retina can be seen, et cetera. You know, if you're seeing a blue haze, even in the, you know, in the bright light, in the dark, different times of the day when the, when the iris isn't necessarily super dilated, it may be nothing to worry about at all, but it may be something. So definitely have it checked out.
All right. And Adam in Pittsfield, my dog got sick from eating something on the street and stopped eating for several days. I took her to the vet for tests, and in the end, it cured itself. But something happened that's still bugging me, which is the vet recommended this crazy expensive canned food that was supposed to be specifically for a sensitive stomach. I love my dog, and I was about to shell out the money, but when I looked at the ingredients, I couldn't pull the trigger. The list was a mile long, and there was almost nothing on it I could pronounce, let alone recognize. If it were me who was sick, there's no way I would eat anything like that. I took her home and just gave her chicken broth for a while instead. What do you think about the food, and did I make the wrong decision?
These foods that are sent home with animals who have gastrointestinal issues are really to support the gastrointestinal tract, and the idea being to feed your dog something that's highly digestible, has a moderate fat restriction, so not super low fat, but moderate fat. You want something that's lactose-free and gluten-free. And the reason for that is because all of these things are important as far as getting over a vomiting diarrhea issue. I think what you're seeing is that, unfortunately, the companies that make these diets mostly are companies that formulate their foods by amino acid with lots of plant-based amino acids. So it is a complete and balanced food, but they're made with a lot of plant material like corn gluten meal, that type of thing. The names that you can't pronounce are probably the micronutrients that are added because you're not getting them in, because it has to be a complete and balanced food, and you also want to sometimes add more nutrients in a dog who's having GI problems. That being said, for a dog who is having vomiting troubles, there's nothing wrong with feeding a whole food diet like boiled chicken. And you're boiling it because you want to take some of the fat out. You want to feed white rice with that, not brown rice, because white rice is highly digestible. Broth is a great thing. Bone broth is good. You're getting more protein with that. You know, all of that is fine. If you have a dog with severe diarrhea, then, you know, there's nothing wrong with feeding those diets for a few days. And the reason being two things. Many people won't cook for their dogs, so we have to have something that we can give them. The second reason is because they have the right types of fiber to help to normalize not only the, to slow down the gut, basically slows down the gut a little bit and helps to normalize the bacterial flora in the gut. So things like fructooligosaccharides, they tend to help with, they don't delay stomach emptying, but they are going to help with
binding.
Basically, gut motility.
Yeah.
And with probiotic growth.
And
so you want to get probiotics with this, too.
Okay, and I would just say that, you know, you can go either way, but one of the things I had to learn way back when is how much, you know, fluid, what's the word I'm looking for? It's fluid, moisture, how much hydration can be lost when a dog's got wicked diarrhea.
Right.
So that's right.
And it's very difficult for them to keep up with it with just drinking water. So the best thing that you can do is, especially in a puppy, is to get them back on track pretty quickly. And the other thing is as the hypersecretory state happens, so the intestine is secreting more fluids into the intestine, and as that goes on, you've got inflammation there. You have the potential to then sensitize your puppy or your dog to some of the foods that you're feeding now, so you have to be careful of that, because you can have run into troubles later on. So the best thing to do is to try to get the diarrhea cleared up as quickly as possible. And these foods, feeding them for a few days is really, in my opinion, not a problem.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cannon. As always, this has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. Who let the dogs out?